I want to welcome everyone to the 436th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. We're glad to be able to restart our meetings after a year and a half of suspending them because of the pandemic. It's nice to see all of you here today and to welcome those listening on the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look, the president of the Forum. Since 1983, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert talk about and answer questions about issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. These Forum meetings provide citizens with the opportunity to learn about and discuss the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and the factors influencing them. Details about and audios of past Forum talks, upcoming Forum programs, and information on how to become a member of the Forum are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today, we are very pleased to have Sean McFate with us to speak on the future of war. Dr. Sean McFate is a strategist and expert on international relations. He is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a professor at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, Syracuse University School, Maxwell School, and the National Defense University. He is also an advisor to Oxford University's Center for Technology and Global Affairs. He is a regular consultant to the Pentagon, the CIA, and Hollywood, and has appeared on all major news networks, as well as being a contributing writer to numerous print publications. Dr. McFate has a rather unconventional background that cuts across public, private, and nonprofit sectors. He began his career as a paratrooper and officer in the U.S. Army's 82nd Airborne Division. He then became a private military contractor and paramilitary, where he worked primarily in Africa and Eastern Europe. Dr. McFate has been a vice president at TD International, a program manager at DynCorp Corporation, a consultant at Bering Point, which is now Deloitte Consulting, and an associate at Booz Allen and Hamilton. He has authored several highly praised nonfiction books on modern warfare and is a successful novelist. In addition, he has published 18 academic articles and 2 monographs for the U.S. Department of Defense. Dr. McFate holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from Brown University, a master's degree in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a doctorate in international relations from the London School of Economics. Sean, it's truly an impressive range of accomplishments, and we want to welcome you to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thank you, and lovely to be in Maine. Lovely to especially leave Washington, D.C., but I always love coming to Maine. So I wrote this, but this book, The New Rules of War, came out a few years ago. It is being read widely from not just within our own national security establishment, but in the UK, Western Europe, Singapore, and some places. Some hate it, some love it. It's okay. I wrote it to start a conversation and not end one. The reason why I wrote this book is because I was angry. Like maybe some of you, I have known good friends who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. As a taxpayer, it's hurtful to see trillions of dollars spent there with very little to show for it, in my opinion. And as a vet, it is hateful to see our American image tarnished internationally by what I consider to be low-level foes. Yet, if we're honest with ourselves, the last time we won a big war was 1945. If we're honest with ourselves. Now, yes, there's the Gulf War, 1990, 1991. We were back in there, Grenada, Dominican Republic. But the last time we defeated decisively in a big war was World War II. Yet, we have the best military in the world. Even our adversaries acknowledge this. So the central question of the book, The New Rules of War, is what's the problem? If we have the best military, then why haven't we won a war in 70 years? It's an uncomfortable question to ask, especially in Washington, D.C. And I wrote this several years ago, but on recent events, I think you would agree that we must at least consider this question. Consider this question. So the answer, bottom line up front, is that warfare has moved on, but we have not. How wars are fought have changed drastically in the 70 years, but we really haven't moved and kept up with it. Our adversaries have, but not us. So we have something that I call victor's curse. What is victor's curse? Well, you've heard the saying that generals always like to fight the last war, especially if they won it. Now, obviously, it doesn't mean all generals, and it doesn't just mean, you know, uniformed members. It includes, you know, national security establishments. This is especially true if you're a victorious nation like ours. We won World War II. We are the great power. Everybody has to adapt to our way of everything, including warfare. The idea that the weak can eclipse us seems, you know, impossible. Now, let's go back in time. Let's get into our time machine for an example of victor's curse. I don't want to talk about the U.S. in this context. Let's go back to 100 years ago to this war, World War I, a horrific war. Now, at the end of this war, France had a bad case of victor's curse. Clemenceau at the Treaty of Versailles, this is a picture of him, he's in a bushy mustache. He and the general staff of France at that point thought the next war would look just like the last successful one. And remember, they were a victor in World War I. So what kind of warfare do you think they imagined the future as being? Trench warfare with better technology. It'd be World War I with better technology. And you know what they invested in as their super weapon, right? The Maginot Line. The Maginot Line. Now, the Maginot Line is arguably one of the greatest military fortification systems in history. And the idea is if Germany came across, you know, the gap, they would stop them at the border, and they could sustain that trench warfare for a lifetime. And perhaps some of you actually have been to the Maginot Line. It's still impressive to this day. These underground railroads and encasements and barracks, and it's really very impressive. There's just one problem. We know how this ended, right? The Blitzkrieg. The plucky and in some ways desperate Germans, they innovated their way of warfare and came up with new technologies, new weapons, new tactics, new stratagems, new ways of communicating and thinking so that their entire warfare changed and rendered the Maginot Line completely obsolete. And what they couldn't do in four bloody years of World War I, the Germans achieved in just 6 weeks in World War II. Panzers were rolling down Paris avenues. And the French high command was stuck in cognitive dissonance. They still couldn't understand what was happening to it to them as it was happening. They failed to evolve because they were stuck behind the false security of their Maginot Line. And this is the problem with war futurists, whether it's back then or in Washington, D.C. right now, is that they think they're looking ahead, but they're actually looking in the rear view mirror. This is victor's curse. And what they see, what the French saw, was World War II, their last victorious, you know, war. What we see is We see World War II. It is still the paradigm of warfare for the United States. Conventional war, which is sort of World War II style war of state on state, military on military, some nominal, you know, allegiance to the laws of armed conflict. We are still patterned on this. Our military is still creating like World War II with better technology. And it's not just us. It's American society as a whole. You know, Americans think, I mean, think about how many World War II movies come out every year, 70 years later, 80 years later. There are more World War II movies than all the war movies of all the other American wars combined. So the question is, you know, and think about it. We talk about the greatest generation fighting a good war. That's the last time we had a good war. We have normalized the language around it. Okay, so there are, despite this, there are actually war prophets who do accurately see the future of war, but they are almost never believed. I mean, it's a pattern. They have another type of curse called Cassandra's curse. Now, many of you may remember Princess Cassandra from the Iliad in ancient Greece. She was the princess who the gods gave her the gift of prophecy, but the curse that no one would believe her. So she's like, that big horse there, that's full of Greeks. Don't let it into the city gates, right? And like, oh, sit down, Cassandra, you're full of it. And so let's go back in time, looking at a real Cassandra. They're very rare. We'll go back in time and look at the same war at this Cassandra, Billy Mitchell. Now, I know some of you have heard, you know of Billy Mitchell. Sometimes my Georgetown students haven't heard of Billy Mitchell, unless they're Air Force, which is sad. But we know Billy Mitchell. He was a World War I U.S. Army aviator and an ace. And he saw the future of war, and it was air power. And when he came back home to Washington, D.C. as a one-star, he told all of his peers, the future of war is air power. We must get ready. And of course, his peers completely laughed at him, fell off their chairs, because they all knew the future of war would look just like the last successful one. Trench warfare, battleships. The next war would be World War I with better technology. Then Billy Mitchell said something heretical. He said, in the future, airplanes can sink battleships. And this people just gasped. Now, there's a picture up here. There's Billy Mitchell in 1919 or 20 standing in front of a biplane. Now, back then, airplanes were little more than motorized kites in the era of the super dreadnought. So when he said, this motorized kite can sink dreadnoughts, this was too fantastical for his peers to understand. But Mitchell had some grit. He had some sand. He convinced the Department of Navy to pull out a captured German battleship from World War I into the Chesapeake Bay, where they did this. They sank it. They sank it. And now, open question, what do you think happens next? Do you think that this, you know, spurred a strategic discussion about the future of war and the potential of air power? Who, just raise a hand if you think that's... Who thinks it did the opposite? Most people, yeah. See, this is wisdom here. When I'm in Georgetown, it's a little bit more 50-50. The latter group is correct. The Navy denied the whole thing. They said this was a publicity stunt, you know, meant to forward this guy's career. This doesn't simulate combat conditions. It proves nothing. But Mitchell was like, no, it was proof of concept. I said we can sink a battleship. We did it. Let's start from there and start thinking about future strategy. And this argument got so vehement that it spilled over from the War Department into congressional politics in the early 20s and into public national media in a pre-Twitter age. So here's a cartoon, a political cartoon from the Chicago Tribune that lays out both perspectives. On the top is the Navy saying that, you know, Mitchell, this proves nothing, this is not combat conditions. And at the bottom is Mitchell in his airplane saying, no, we sank it, didn't we? That's what we said we could do. Now, this got so rancorous that the head general in the War Department, which was General Pershing, you know, pulled Mitchell aside. I got a similar talk to when I was a lieutenant a long time ago. He said, come over here, Billy. take a seat here, please. And he sits down and he says, Billy, you know, he said something like this, you're a pain in my blah, blah, blah. And we need to get you out of town just for a little bit to let this debate simmer down. And then when it simmers down, just come back quietly. I'm doing this to save your career, Billy. And so in typical bureaucratic fashion, they assigned Mitchell to a one-year tour some remote place in the Pacific, other side of the planet. He disappears. Things settle down. He comes back, and Mitchell has a report like 3 inches thick. And in this report, this is 1924, he says, on a Sunday morning at 7:30 a.m., Japan will launch a sneak attack against Pearl Harbor using airplanes. And this will draw the United States and Japan into a total war for the Pacific. He said this in 1924. Predicts Pearl Harbor. Very specific. Very specific. Not a hand wave forecast, right? To an hour. Okay, now what happens to Mitchell? Does this flag officer, is like, do people start taking him seriously? Thinking about this? Anybody want to hazard a guess? He gets court-martialed. He gets court-martialed for conduct unbecoming an officer. My favorite charge. This wasn't just any court-martial. This was a Kim Kardashian court-martial with paparazzi and corrupt judges and witnesses who have been tampered. And three of the judges, all of the flag officers, got kicked out for corruption. His jury, not a single aviator on the jury. And this took place at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C., where I now teach at the National Defense University. And they found him guilty within 30 minutes. He ripped off his uniform saying, I'm done. He crisscrosses the country to anybody who'd listen to him saying, the future of war is air power. It's air power. We must start to get ready. Nobody listened to him. He died a bitter man in the 30s, is buried, refused to be buried at Arlington Cemetery, is buried in Milwaukee, his hometown. And we know how this story ends. Pearl Harbor happens. And the military at that time said they were caught completely by surprise by an unscrupulous enemy, even though one of its own generals was standing on desks nearly 15 years earlier, saying this exact event would occur. So the question is, why do we struggle to accept Cassandras? Why do we struggle? And the answer is this. There's a saying in the business community that culture eats strategy for breakfast. Now, in the context of us in terms of national security, it means that our strategic culture can eclipse our strategic IQ. The culture of Billy Mitchell's day was this. For example, in the Navy, if you wanted to become a four-star admiral, you spent your entire career seeking positions on battleships. They were called capital ships. How many battleships a nation had was a metric of its sovereignty and power. It had been the pride and king of the sea for centuries. So, of course, the best officers wanted to seek, you know, positions on the best ships, which was a battleship. And then here comes this aviator army puke, and he says, oh, in 1920, oh, that's already obsolete. The future will be the flat top, the aircraft carrier, which back then was a prototype that even stunt pilots wouldn't land on. So you can imagine, if you're a four-star admiral hearing this, why this sounds heretical and absurd and dangerous. It took traditional minds the Battle of Midway to understand what Mitchell was talking about. Even Doubting Thomas's got it. Because this, arguably, the most significant naval engagement of the 20th century, Never did the two fleets see each other in Midway. It was fought entirely by aviation, and it turned the tide of the war. It was a strategic battle. Only then did the conservatives finally wake up to what Mitchell had seen 20 years earlier, or 25 years earlier. And quietly, after World War II ended, everybody stopped buying battleships, and the aircraft carrier became the new king of the sea. And that's Mitchell's legacy today. Now, the military didn't apologize to Mitchell, not until much later. But in their way, they kind of did. They named a bomber after him, the B-25 Mitchell bomber, the only American bomber named after a person in World War II. Okay, so let's fast forward. The book, The New Rules of War, argues that we are facing a Billy Mitchell moment right now. That warfare has changed, our adversaries understand this and exploit it, we do not, which is why we struggle against even, low-level foes, and our systems, structures, policies, organizations are not equipped and set up to deal with modern warfare. This is the challenge. So, right now we have this new strategy. 2018, our defense strategy shifted away from counterterrorism and counterinsurgency towards what we call great power competition, or GPC. Everything's an acronym in the DoD. Great power competition really means China and Russia, with China as number one and Russia as number two by most accounts. Now, this new shift away from counterterrorism to great power competition is fine, but that's not the problem. The problem is how the strategy is being read in Washington, D.C. Most people imagine a war with China or Russia as being ultimately a conventional fight. They imagine it as looking like World War II with better technology. The South China Sea is the new battle of Midway, fought with Ford-class carriers, F-35s, and drones. And I argue that it's not going to look that way at all. That's the victor's curse at work. In fact, there's nothing more unconventional today than a conventional war. Our adversaries know that if they go up against us in a military World War II-style fight, they'll get creamed. Not that they want to do that, but they also know that we struggle at unconventional warfare. Think of Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. So guess how they're going to come after us? Not conventionally, unconventionally. And this is the trend of modern warfare. So here's a graph of wars since the end of World War II to 2015. It doesn't change a whole lot since 2015. But as you can see, the red line on the bottom, that's nearly flat, those are traditional conventional wars. Those are traditional state-on-state wars. Think of Israel-Arab wars in the 60s and 70s, India-Pakistan. Those are nearly zeroed out. The blue line on top, which gets bigger and bigger, that's where modern warfare is going. It's unconventional. Unconventional. Again, there's nothing more unconventional than a conventional war. In fact, you could already argue that we are at war with Russia and or China right now, don't know it, and that's by their design. It's a boiling the frog strategy. So when we realize it, it may be too late. That's a debate, but a debate worth having. Now, what kind of war is the U.S. preparing to fight? What do we think the future of war looks like? Well, it's actually a very easy answer to derive, because I like to say that budgets are moral documents because they do not lie. So let's look at what we're investing in. Well, first of all, just so you know, the DoD, the Department of Defense budget is gigantic. We spend more in our military than all the other departments combined, right? So if you think about all the departments and agencies, State Department, the CIA, the USA, Department of Agriculture, the Department of Defense gets more than all them
combined. In fact, our Department of Defense, our military, we spend more on our military than the next 10 biggest militaries in the world combined, including Russia or China. Now, does it mean that money is spent wisely? No, I'm not suggesting that. It's just trying to scope and frame the types of, you know, how much money we're spending. So the question is, what are we buying? Because that shows you where we're placing our bets for what kind of instruments or weapons we think the future wars will have or need. Well, here's a list from fiscal year 2018. Now, if you look at this list, these are the top 10 acquisitions. It could be 2017, 2019. It doesn't change a whole lot, except for recently we started to reinvest in our nuclear arsenal, nuclear weapons are not, you know, conventional war. If you look at this list, like F-35s, you know, destroyers, you know, fighter jets, helicopters, what kind of wars are they tooled to fight? What kind of warfare are they tooled to fight? Conventional warfare. They are all tooled to fight a conventional, like World War II with better technology. Now, I have friends in Washington, the Pentagon, at RAND, who say, fine, McFate, that's fine, but they can all do unconventional fights too. Because we talked about how warfare is trending towards unconventional war, and conventional war is very rare. And, you know, yeah, they say like an F-35, it can do unconventional fights too. And my response is, yeah, and a Ferrari can tow a boat. It doesn't make it a good idea. Right? Now, I'm just going to pick on one of these for a second, the F-35. I don't think there's any F-35 pilots in the audience. Good? Okay. Because in many ways, I could pick any of these, but the F-35 is probably the best known. So the F-35 is a fighter jet. It is without doubt one of the most amazing machines ever conceived, engineered, built, and flown or used by human minds and hands. It is amazing. Its cockpit is like a bunch of iPads. The pilot has this this helmet on him or her that allows like X-ray vision, where they can look through the fuselage during a dogfight to see the enemy fighters, because the airplane has sensors all around it, right? It can do air-to-ground, air-to-air. It can do flying espionage. It can do collective targeting, where it flies over a battlefield. And it could, you know, instantly tell, okay, this destroyer fires in that target, and this, you know, missile launcher fires in that target. It does it instantly. There's just one problem with the F-35, and that's completely obsolete. Just like the battleship was in the 1920s, it's tooled to fight last century's war rather than this century's war. I mean, the last time we had a strategic dogfight was the Korean War. So why do we need more fighter jets at all, especially manned ones? And all the things it can do, we already have airplanes that do it better. B-52s can deliver bigger bombing payloads further than an F-35. The A-10, you know, Groundhog, this close air support, airplane can do better air to ground. In fact, in mock air trials, F-15s and F-16s that were 40 years old could sneak up on the stealth warrior and blow it out of the sky. So, you know, in 20 years, guess how many combat missions this thing has racked up? We've been at war for 20 years now. Anyone want to hazard a guess? Zero. Zero combat missions. We've been at war for 20 years, zero combat missions. Now, to be fair, the Department of Defense got a little sensitive to its bad war record, and in 2018 sent one or two out to bomb like a weapons cache in Iraq and Afghanistan to notch up a battle win. But this is 2018, and I'm an old infantry grunt, I'm an old paratrooper. If the enemy can't shoot back, then it's really not a combat mission, right? So, and it was never designed to take out weapons caches, right? That's not what it was designed to do. Now, you know, let me ask you this. How much do you think the whole program costs taxpayers and allies, the F-35 program? What's that? Yeah, okay. Yeah. $1.5 trillion for a single-seat airplane that doesn't go to war, right? And, you know, to give you, to put that in perspective, I'm a liberal arts major. I don't do math. So to give, you know, all those zeros, $1.5 trillion is more than Russia's GDP on an on a single-seat airplane that doesn't go to war. In fact, if this airplane were a nation state, its GDP would be ranked 11th in the world, ahead of Saudi Arabia. And it's not just the F-35, it's everything. It's the Ford-class carrier, $13 billion a ship, before you add sailors and aircraft. Do we need more aircraft carriers? I don't think so. I mean, in the era of the hypersonic, you know, missile, it could make the supercarrier obsolete. The point is that all these weapon systems are super expensive. They are our Maginot Line. They are meant to fight last century's successful wars and not the wars that we have to face. This is called the Maginot mentality, and we have it. Not everybody, but the Washington consensus, the blob, what do you want to call it, has it, the groupthink. Okay, so I've been ranting for a bit about what war is not going to be in the future. Let's think about what war is going to be. And that's what the book, The New Rules of War, sets out. So what does the future of war look like? Warfare is getting sneakier. It's getting sneakier. So why is it getting sneakier? Because we live in an information age and have been for the last three decades at least. Every decade it gets increased. And so what this means is that in the future, or actually now, weapons that give you plausible deniability are more important than raw firepower. In fact, deception eclipses lethality in modern war, competition, statecraft. We're investing lethality like F-35s and missiles and helicopters and destroyers, but that's not where the future of war is. It's not where current war is. So let's look at an example. Let's look at Russia, who gets this. They are a disinformation superpower. Let's look at the example of the Ukraine. Now, when they took the Ukraine in 2013, 14, around there, they were very clever. Now, in the old days, in conventional war, and I call the old rules of war, when the Soviet Union wanted to put its boot on the neck of a neighboring country, it'd roll in the tanks. Think of Hungary 56, Czechoslovakia 68. They could have done that with Ukraine in 2014. Their military was, you know, could have easily blitzkrieged into eastern Ukraine. But that's not what they led with. What they led with were weapon systems and stratagems that gave him plausible deniability, like special forces, mercenaries like the Wagner Group, Little Green Men, these fake Russian separatist units, loads of active measures and propaganda. They basically created the fog of war in Ukraine. So when Western policymakers were scratching their head about what was going on the ground, factually, the Crimea was already a fait accompli. And only then did Putin say, oh, here I am, it's us now. And only then did the tanks roll in and the destroyers roll in. It was seized by these shadowy figures. And I call this shadow war. It's sort of a type of irregular warfare where the goal is to keep the war beneath the threshold of global media. Because if you can do that, you can win. And that's what Libya is like today. We have no idea who's fighting in Libya and why. We have mercenaries and mercenaries, there's insurgent groups, we have warlords. It's all under a fog of war. Sometimes it bubbles up to something that's high intensity that makes Fox News or CNN, but then it quickly goes down. That's how modern wars are fought, in the shadows. Now, we're also seeing one of the return of mercenaries globally. And the reason is because they give superb plausible deniability in an information age. So if U.S. Army Green Berets or Navy SEALs get captured, you're going to be on video, you're going to be on YouTube. But if you capture mercenaries and they speak Russian or English, you don't know exactly who they work for. They may not know exactly who they work for. So if you want plausible deniability, you go with mercenaries. And we're seeing the rise of mercenaries everywhere. So here's a map of the world where major mercenary activity was just a couple places 25 years ago, like in Sub-Saharan Africa, Papua New Guinea, the Balkans. And that was kind of it. And that was mostly because of one mercenary company in South Africa called Executive Outcomes. Let's fast forward to today. We see mercenary activity. This is major international mercenary activity, not the onesies and twosies, all over the world. This map has operations in Africa, in Asia, in Venezuela, in Japan. We had a bunch of Green Beret, ex-Green Beret mercenaries rescue or extract or exfil the CEO of Nissan, who was under house arrest by the Tokyo authorities for corruption in Nissan. And they spirited him away to Beirut, where he's at today. You know, the assassination of the president of Haiti. And there's almost no accountability for this stuff, right? So we're seeing the rise of mercenaries. And we can talk about that. But with the rise of mercenaries, suddenly a lot of people around the world are saying, maybe I can use those guys or gals, including new types of non-state actors, where the super rich can become superpowers. So here's a chart by the World Bank. It shows that the world's top 100 revenue generators, only a third of them are states. Two-thirds of them are multinational corporations. And we cannot assume that multinational corporations are always patriotic. They're multinational, and they have their own national security interests, if you will. And now with the rise of mercenaries, they have a way to defend them without having to rely on corrupt host national governments. Or the super rich. This comes from Credit Suisse, a bank. They estimate global wealth, the top 1% of individuals hold about 43% of the world's global wealth. The top 10% owns 82%. The bottom half of the world's population owns less than 1%. These individuals now are more like emperors or kings of a former era than, oh, I'm a citizen of Mexico or something like that. And they may use mercenaries, in fact, they already are, and also private CIAs and these mercenary hackers called hackback companies to defend and protect their global interests. This will change politics as we know it globally, because rule number 8 is that now you may have wars without states. And we already see these things in south of our border, in Latin America, for example, where you have narco states. You have narco groups fighting each other, and the boundaries of Guatemala, Mexico, Salvador are really porous and kind of irrelevant in many ways. And they capture states. We call them narco states. Much of sub-Saharan Africa is the same way. I think Taliban will be the same way in Afghanistan. So this idea that states drive warfare, they drive international relations and global affairs, the world that we grew up with in sixth grade is changing where that's not always the case. Some of the most powerful world actors will be non-state actors, and they will be armed and dangerous. Rule number 5 is sort of this idea that warfare is becoming more epistemological. In philosophy, epistemology is how do you know what is true versus what's false? How do you know what you know? And in the global information age, where everything is, disinformation now is now a WMD, right? I'm going to show you, for example, a deep fake. A deep fake is basically, well, you'll see. Now, on the video, for radio listeners, you're going to hear a president's voice.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, For instance, they could have me say things like, I don't know, Killmonger was right, or Ben Carson is in the sunken place, or how about this, simply, President Trump is a total and complete dipshit. Now, you see, I would never say these things, at least not in a public address, but someone else would. Someone like Jordan Peele. This is a dangerous time. Moving forward, we need to be more vigilant with what we trust from the internet. That's a time when we need to rely on trusted news sources. It may sound basic, but how we move forward in the age of information is going to be the difference between whether we survive or whether we become some kind of fucked up dystopia. Thank you. And stay woke, bitches.
So that's a deep fake made in some guy's kitchen. Imagine what a cunning adversary can do with this. Have the CGSC, the National Security Council, go and declare war or something like that. Or have Biden or whomever say something that was completely inappropriate. We're getting to a point now where old-fashioned conventional war, where you win on battlefields. That was the old rules of war. Battlefield victory, Waterloo, you know, Gettysburg, Midway, Stalingrad, Berlin. That decided winners and losers. No longer. The future of war or present war, wars are won and lost in people's minds. Strategic deception, strategic influence, trying to influence outcomes of elections by disinformation. You know, what Russia tries to do that in the EU, you know, the United States, and it's compelling their strategic logic. It's this: who cares about the sword if you can manipulate the mind that wields it? And they're investing heavily in these types of weapons, and so is China with their three warfare strategy. In fact, battlefield victory may be obsolete. I mean, we all remember this, mission accomplished in 2003. You know, President Bush standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier declaring mission accomplished after we defeated the Iraq military. It meant nothing. It meant nothing. So I'll sort of end on this. So rule number 10 is victory is fungible. There's these 10 new rules of war, ideas of war, principles. I don't really care what you call them. But victory is fungible means this. There are many ways to win, and not just battlefield victory, which is the only way we generally think about winning. And in fact, one of our problems, in my opinion, is that, you know, if you don't know what victory looks like, then how can you achieve it? Half of winning is knowing what it looks like. And think about this if we look back on 20 years of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, what did victory look like? We didn't really know. So let me ask you a question about this. We'll stop talking about Russia. Start talking about China. When was the last time anybody in this room saw a Hollywood movie with China as the villain? I hear crickets. Any? I mean, we have, you know, Russian villains, American villains. We have China, you know, over here. If you can. 1963, Dr. No. That's pretty good. I would say you're right. I've asked this question lots of times. Sometimes we get a movie like in the 1990s, there was a couple with Jackie Chan. But, you know, in the last, you know, in our millennia, let's leave it to that, you don't. Isn't it curious? We even have American villains. We have terrorist villains, but no Chinese villains? Well, the answer is because they bought Hollywood. Legally. We talk about how warfare is getting more epistemological. They just got an epistemology WMD right here. And, you know, if next, like, Legacy or Legend Studios, Chinese-owned. Next time you see a movie, you know those studio pre-credits before a movie? See if any of them in Mandarin. All right? And what this means is that China gets to control its narrative of always being the good guy. Movies that want to show, like studios that want to show them a Chinese villain, will never make it past the green light phase of movie making in Hollywood. Even if you're Sony Studios, you're not owned by China. China is the second biggest movie market in the world after North America. So if you want your movie to be shown in China, you must hand over your movie to the Beijing censors who censor heavily. And these are all movies from like Top Gun to The Martian. Remember The Martian, where it's like Chinese NASA who saves the day. Looper, the future is China. In fact, how many of you have heard of this movie? Wolf Warrior. Wolf Warrior 2. Yeah, because it was banned in the United States of America. Banned. And it still grossed $800 million plus dollars globally, which is George Clooney money. Now, in this movie, I'll tell you, once I explain this movie, you can see this movie poster, you'll see why it was banned. At the top of this movie poster, it has this, like, this Chinese Special Forces guy. He is like Rambo. He's like their most lethal guy who, big heart of gold, doesn't take to authority very well. He sees on TV, Chinese TV, an American private military company, which is a thinly veiled, you know, U.S. Navy SEALs, U.S. Army Green Berets, you know, in Africa, beating up Chinese nationals there and preying on local populations. He goes to China, he leaves China and goes to West Africa to kick butt, and he does. And in the end, he kills all the American soldiers, and everybody cheers, and there's heroic music, and curtain falls down, the end. This grossed $800 million around the world. Americans have never heard of it. It was banned, but that's what the rest of the world's watching. And if you look at, you know, the failures of recently in Kabul, it starts to have a thematic theme, you know, develop here. So here's the point. This is not just about film theory. There's a form of victory where all of our grandkids speak Mandarin as a second language and, you know, are sympathetic to Beijing values. It's what we did to Germany after World War II. When the Berlin Wall fell down, West Germans all spoke English. They loved America, American culture, the capitalist, you know, democracy, etc. That's a form of winning. It's hegemonic victory. You know, and that's what we're fighting for. It's not the Battle of Taiwan, it's hegemonic victory. Now, I'll just fast forward quickly, saying that we don't need to be, this is not a boo-hoo moment. We can do very well. We just need to up our strategic IQ. We can still do well if we rethink what war is, if we leave our Maginot mentality behind and realize that there's more to war than warfare, and there's more to warfare than lethality. And that's why I wrote these 10 new rules of war. Rules 1 through 4 are things that we have to stop doing. And rules 5 through 10 are things that we have to start doing. I won't read them out right now, but at this point, we'll take some Q&A. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, John. Extremely, extremely interesting. While we're collecting questions, and I'm not sure we're going to have a whole lot of time for Q's and A's, but I always, as the moderator, take advantage of that to ask the first question. Who's responsible in the U.S. for us still trying to plan for the last war? Is it the military-industrial complex? Is it Congress and the government?
It's a good question. Like, who's responsible? It's a lot of things. First of all, I think victorious nations tend to look backwards and forwards because they can. If you're an ambitious nation, doesn't have much, you get lean and hungry and you innovate. We're not. We have the Maginot mentality. Obviously, the military-industrial complex has something to do with this, right? We've had secretaries of defense saying we don't need more F-18s. The Secretary of the Navy just said that. And Congress says, oh, but you're going to take them. You're going to take them. So there's that. There's other reasons for that, why, you know, generals and admirals retire from the Pentagon and show up on boards of the military-industrial construct or whatever. I think also Americans themselves are partly to think about. I mean, less than 1% of America serves in uniform. And so their visions of current and future war come from Hollywood, come from policymakers who are themselves having this problem. I think if when I talk to like special forces, they get this is not a controversy for them. Like, of course, this is the contemporary and future war. Why don't more Americans get it? So I think it's incumbent upon all of us to be more realistic about how war is waged and how it's won and lost.
The U.S., I think, here's a question about the U.S. engaging in some of these newer actions. Were the assassinations of bin Laden and Soleimani isolated examples of the U.S. participating in the new warfare?
It's a good question. So bin Laden was purely symbolic. And we should have left Afghanistan then, if not in December of 2001, when we actually achieved our goal, which is to push al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, which we did. But Soleimani is a different story. So General Soleimani, he is an Iranian general who is the general, he was a general patent of this new type of warfare, of shadow war, rule number 9. And that, I think, is an example of this, because you can replace people, but you can't replace brains and minds. And that's what he was. And that really, and he was a guy who kind of was in charge of Quds and Hezbollah, and what they couldn't achieve in the 1980s using conventional war, Iran achieved in the last decade using these types of stratagems.
And here's a couple of similar type questions. One is about U.S. soft power and whether it's waning, or did the Chinese and Russians really learn from us and we're just stuck in a rut. And the other one is kind of soft power as well. Are we talking about a decline in cultural imperialism, something the Brits and the French understood a bit?
Are we in the decline of cultural imperialism?
Yeah.
Well, many around
for the U.S.
Yeah, so those are two different questions. So many around the world are celebrating our departure from Afghanistan as this is the end of our empire. And that's a different discussion. Is America an empire? And that's an interesting historical discussion. I'm not, as Mark Twain said, news of my death is untrue, or something like some paraphrase. But somebody here will, some Hawthorne-ish person will remind me as soon as I get off the stage. Look, soft power yes, they have learned. We as a democracy, the White House has no lever for soft power in it. DOD has tried to weaponize soft power, it realizes it can't. You hear DOD folks sometimes whinge that why can't there be more movies like Top Gun, and they're less critical of, and that's just the nature of it. But here's the if you step back, if you look at these rules, these 10 new rules of modern and future warfare, you will see that they favor autocracies and disfavor democracies. As war goes into the shadows, it becomes more secretive. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that if we need to get in the shadows and punch back, because modern conventional deterrence is not working at all. The only way to do this is get in the shadows and punch back, but we all know from the Church Committee of 75, 76 that secrets and democracy are not compatible. So the real national security debate we need to have as a country is if this is the trend of modern warfare, how do we fight as a democracy secretly without losing our democratic soul? That's not how many F-35s we need. It's this question. And it's not one author who has the answer. It has to be a discourse. And I also talk about rule number 9. We think about democracies as being very vulnerable to disinformation because we have open elections, open societies. But we are more resilient. Autocracies have more power, and they centralize it, but they're also much more brittle. In rule number 9, I discuss how, if we wanted to, we could really use that to take down autocracies down a peg or two. The question is, are we willing to do that?
Yep. Thank you. Here's one near and dear to my heart, since I worked on weapons of mass destruction stuff my entire career. And that is, why didn't the development of nuclear weapons change the military paradigm?
Well,
I mean, you haven't talked much about the role of, you know, weapons of mass destruction.
That's because you're up here, George. I didn't want to say anything. Okay. So WMD, it's interesting. We've had deja vu recently. So nuclear weapons totally changed warfare in the 1950s and 60s. Nuclear weapons are not conventional warfare. They are unconventional. Conventional warfare, think of it as, you know, World War II style. And what that meant in the 50s under, like, Eisenhower's New Look policy was that war was going to go into the shadows like this, because the Soviets and Americans couldn't risk a direct confrontation because that would lead to World War III, nuclear war, right? So it changed. But then the Berlin Wall fell down, and we forgot all that. And we also had Tom Clancy. And that's the other problem, Tom Clancy. Anybody here read Red Storm Rising, maybe? Yeah, so this was a 1986-7 book about World War III between, you know, the Soviet Union and NATO. And of course, the good guys win, we know that. But in this scenario, it's a conventional war. It's World War II. Never does it go nuclear, which is bizarre. Bizarre. And if you look at DoD war games today, a lot of them have these things with China and the South China Sea over Taiwan where it never goes nuclear. I'm like, it might go nuclear in days. We can't assume that. So there's a deja vu, an ignorance at play here about weapons of mass destruction, questions about limited nuclear warfare in our lifetime, breaking the nuclear taboo. I don't think people think about it as sharply as they must.
Thank you. And I wish we had time for a whole lot more questions, but I think I'll ask the key question here, which is, what is war? Do you have a definition for what
war
is?
Good question. So war, the answer is, war is armed politics, period. It's armed politics. Now, we are really good at getting the armed part right, right? Our soldiers dutifully win battles, but we lose wars because we don't get the politics right, whether it's Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan. You have to realize that war is armed politics, and at the strategic level of war, what that means literally is that military victories can translate into political ones, and political victories can translate into military ones. We don't have, for a variety of reasons, we don't have that right now. When I hear people talk about strategy in Washington, whether they be, you know, generals or journalists or think tanks, they often talk about tactics rather than strategy. And that's the problem. War is armed politics. We have to start thinking more like that. And war now, being cunning is more important than just being strong. So being David rather than Goliath. And we can do that. Our country has really cunning people. They're just not in the national security circles right now. And I think we can, because I'll just end on this. As I think good strategists, not everybody can be a good strategist, but a good strategist can come from anybody or anywhere. And that's what we have to think about. Thank you very much.
Thank you.